Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Howdy, everybody, and this week we are traveling back to 1958 to discuss Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, starring James Stewart and Kim Novak. This movie is a little bit more about character and emotion than it is about plot, which makes it harder to place the plot in coherent sentences. But I am going to try right now. A detective is forced to retire after his fear of heights causes the death of a fellow officer and the girl he was hired to follow. He sees the devil of the girl, causing him to transform her image onto the dead girl's body. This leads into a cycle of madness and lies. So, Dad, why did you choose this film?
I chose this film because in the early 2000s, they restored the film and re-released it, and I watched it on DVD, and I really enjoyed it because I had studied it in film school, and because in 2012, Sight and Sound, when they did their once every 10 years, the critics all get together, they vote for us the best movies that to do the top 100, and Vertigo had overtaken Citizen Kane. For the longest time, Citizen Kane was considered on their poll, the best movie ever made. And so I wanted to go back and really look at it and go, I liked it, but it wasn't even my favorite Hitchcock film. Does that make sense? And so I wanted to kind of like go back there and go, hey, is it really that good? Is it a super masterpiece? And so I thought it was interesting that the critics picked it number, in 2012, the Sight and Sound critics picked it number one. The directors picked it number seven. It was, so that even though there's a disparity, both groups really think highly of this film. And I remember when I was in film school, we discussed it a lot. I read a lot of books about it. When you read a modern Hitchcock book, a book made about Hitchcock in the last 20, 25 years, there's definitely going to be a section about Vertigo in it. But if you go before that, it wasn't really held to that high esteem. It's definitely a film that's created over the years the audience that really loves and respects this film. So I wanted to go back and look at that, and I wanted to see how it is. I wanted to see it with you too. Unfortunately, we didn't watch it in the best circumstances. Our DVD player wouldn't work. So we had to go find it on another channel, and then it kept on getting interrupted with commercials, which at first I was thinking that wasn't going to be a big deal, but I didn't realize how much of a slow burn this movie was. And I think it kept on popping me out of the movie because this is a movie that kind of builds, every scene builds on each other. And so when you stop it, but I still really enjoyed it.
Yeah, the big pharma ads didn't do it for you?
No, I didn't. But at the same time, it's like, it was the only way we had to watch it at the moment.
So you said that this was considered the critic's favorite, and you were confused because it's not your favorite. So I want to know, what is your favorite Hitchcock film?
Well, my favorite Hitchcock film is another one that's actually on the list. It's like down in the teens, I think, is North by Northwest. I think that's the best one for structure, filmmaking he does, the tenseness, the way that I found it the best overall Hitchcock film. And then I also really like Rear Window for another Jimmy Stewart Hitchcock film. I really like that one.
Perry Mason's the villain.
Yeah. And I also like Shadow of a Doubt, which is one I really enjoy. And Trouble with Harry is another one that I really enjoy. So there's different ones that I like. But I think my favorite one is definitely North by Northwest. Out of all, if I go back and I watch that periodically.
I think my favorite out of all of them would probably be Rear Window. And I think it's because it's technically a bottle movie. Nothing really happens outside except for outside of this circumstance.
Yeah.
And I think that I kind of like those films where it's kind of like, is the person going crazy? Is the person not going crazy? They can't leave the house, so you can't be proven right or wrong. So it's kind of,
Yeah. I mean, there's other movies that are really good, like To Catch a Thief and Dial M for Murder. And there's ones throughout that I really like.
Well, I think, to be honest, Rear Window in today's cinematic world is probably the one that I think connects. There's this subculture of horror mystery that's coming on to like the streaming service and stuff. That's about usually a woman who's either alcoholic or agoraphobic who stays in her house and witnesses a crime from her window. The one that I recently watched was with Amy Adams called The Woman in the Window, where it was like, is she crazy? Is she not crazy? Is she drinking too much? Because she's also dealing with grief and stuff. So it's like that affecting it. And that's kind of why I like Rear Window, because it's like, is she going stir crazy? Granted, I also think it's a great pandemic movie because it's like, are we going crazy?
Yeah.
And I recently, and I watched these movies in the pandemic.
I think it's one of the things, too, about Hitchcock that is why he's so relevant today versus some of the other filmmakers who were making films that may even have been more critically well-received at that time, is because his films were so solidly constructed. He spent time constructing the films, and he would work on their story structure, and then he would hire somebody to write the screenplay a lot of the times. Like this film and North by Northwest, he structured them and did storyboards. He came up as a set designer, so he knew how to sketch out storyboards. They weren't like super detailed, but it gave everybody an idea. And then the screenwriter would come on, and then he'd work with the screenwriter to make sure that it fit the structure. So he wasn't having to try to, so I think that's one of the things that makes his films so interesting in today's audience, because they're still so structurally sound, and they might be considered a little bit slow or maybe some of the topics or some of the characters are questionable. We have to look at that later on, but it's like one of the things that you look at his films, they definitely hold up because of that. And I think so filmmakers can go back, they can watch his films back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, when he was really good at the height of his game, use them as their own film school. And then when they go make these projects, they can go, this is the structure, this is how you should do it. Or they, because Hitchcock has established, done one of the major filmmakers who's really worked at establishing that, they can now make a project that plays against that. And they know that the audience has seen it enough that we expect the jump scare to be there because of what we've seen. And then, nope, I'm actually going to fool you, and it's going to be over here, or the story is going to go over there, because they're playing with the expectation that we've been built because of Hitchcock and people like him who created those films. But he's one of the best filmmakers and still one of the most well-watched filmmakers for a reason.
So one of the reasons why I can see why people voted for this movie being number one or being really high on their list is the look of the film, and yes, also the technology behind the film. Like most people know, this is one of the first films to use CGI.
It did two things first that it became very famous for: the vertigo effect and the use of CGI, because the designer of the opening sequence, Saul Bass, he was famous for making movie posters and doing opening sequences, the graphic sequences of films. He did North by Northwest. He did Anatomy of a Murder. He did a bunch of films at that time that were big films. And ironically, he kind of falls out of favor in the later part of the 60s and 70s. And he's brought back by people like Martin Scorsese and stuff like that, who saw him, who grew up on his films and loved his films. And they got brought back to do like Casino and stuff. So by the time towards the end of his career in 1990s, he's actually using conventional CGI, like what we would consider CGI, with an actual computer on a desk. And it's kind of interesting. But the CGI that he uses is they take a anti-aircraft gun mount that's used to sight the gun mechanically, and they modify that to create the swirl effect. And it's a mechanical computer. Like they program it so it makes that swirl effect. Take five soldiers to rotate it properly, and then it would make the design that he had programmed into it. And that's why it's considered the first CGI used in the film, because it's a mechanical computer, but it's not what we would consider nowadays.
You said that you mentioned that he did a lot of posters, and you mentioned some of Hitchcock films. Did he do the Vertigo poster?
Yeah, he did the Vertigo poster.
Because I think when someone tells me, like, pick a poster that's iconic or, like, the best movie poster of all time, Vertigo is definitely up there in my list, and or usually the first or second poster that pops into my head.
Yeah, and he really wanted to work that swirl into the Vertigo poster and into the opening sequence.
And I'm talking about the one where...
It's orange.
The orange, and yeah. There's a swirl, and there's a man and a woman, and they look like they're falling.
Yep. That's the one that he can design. He did something very similar for The Man with the Golden Arm, Anatomy of a Murder. He's really good at designing that look. And then, of course, once you get to a certain point in your career, there's studios who don't want to hire you, that hire somebody else to copy your look. So there was some of that, too. Some of the stuff that's attributed to him isn't done by him.
Vertigo is very famous for one particular scene. I think I've seen that scene more than any Hitchcock scene ever. And I think the first time that I watched this particular scene, I was in seventh grade drama class, and the drama teacher was like, "Amazing, gorgeous, look at this wonderful thing." And that was all he could show us because we were seventh graders. And so what I'm talking about is the expanding staircase shot, which will eventually be called the Vertigo effect.
It's used twice in the film. At the beginning, when James Stewart jumps over from rooftop to rooftop, misses, and slides down and is hanging on a gutter. And then a police officer who jumped over and is trying to help him slips and falls. And then when James Stewart looks down, you see the Vertigo effect, where it looks like the world is lengthening and his perspective is shifting in camera. And then later on, when he's trying to run up the staircase, which is the more famous shot, the staircase of the bell tower, he looks down and you see, again, the perspective shifting. The staircase is getting longer, even though he's staying in the same spot. So it's all done in camera. It's an optical effect. It's called now the dolly zoom. Because what you're doing is you're zooming in as your dolly is pulling away, or you're zooming out as the dolly is going in to give the effect that you want, so that the forefront never changes and the people in the forefront never changes, but the background shifts. There's two modern examples of it that are really famous, like the scene in Jaws where Sheriff Brody is sitting on the beach and he realizes there's a shark out in the water, and he looks up and you just see the whole world behind him shift and change. And the other time is in Goodfellas, where Robert De Niro and Ray Liotta are sitting in a diner talking, and Ray Liotta's character is realizing his life is about to change. So that's basically the Vertigo effect, which was created for this film. In fact, they actually built the set, the 70-foot set of the bell tower, and they were trying to figure out how they could do it with a camera looking down the bell tower, and they could never get it to work right. So what they did, they ended up building a scale model, tipping it on its side so the camera's looking down it, and they ended up doing it as a model special effects shot, which is why in the final shot you don't see Jimmy Stewart's hands on the railing, even though they should be if he's looking down. When you were watching this film, I kind of prepared you for it. I said it's a slow burn. It's a movie where it builds on, builds and builds on itself, and it's kind of like you're not going to get this immense thing at the beginning that's going to propel you through the movie. It's almost like you don't really know what propels him through the movie, but when you finally see it, which is Kim Novak's character, you understand that's what you're going to be following. Did you have, were you generally interested in the characters at the beginning, or did you have to build any interest into the characters, or did you ever get interested in the characters?
I got interested in the characters at the beginning. Thought it was a really neat mystery that was set up for us at the beginning, and I really enjoyed the ending of this movie. There was definitely a part in the middle where I was like, this movie's going on for a little bit too long. I kind of have things to do. Is this movie going to end? And then they would, then something would happen, and I'd be like, never mind, I got time. I want to watch this film. Okay. So it was kind of, it's kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but like the mystery intrigued me. Then the sappiness and the romance kind of went, pulled me out of the film, and then the mystery brought me back in.
Okay. So do you think that his obsession was sappy?
Well, I also have a really hard time with romantic comedies or just romance or anything that happens over a 3-day period of time. Well, one of the things that I thought was very interesting in this film is that you don't really know a lot about Madeline. Madeline shows up in a gray suit, which famously, you know, was designed for her character to give her kind of a blank slate look, including natural makeup and her hair pulled back. Nothing fancy, nothing iconic, really, about her. Nothing's going to pull you away from her. And I thought that was very interesting in the fact that you don't know anything about her character except for that she's the main mystery of, like, is she possessed? Is she not? Is she mentally ill? Things like that. So when Jimmy Stewart's character is like, I love you, I'm kind of like, you don't know anything about this woman. How are you in love with her? And so sometimes like that, it kind of, and I think you were mentioning before that some of these characters in Hitchcock's canon could be considered problematic today. And I think, to be honest, a man lusting over a woman that doesn't really have her own personality and doesn't really have her own backstory and is kind of maybe mentally ill, may not be, to me is kind of not okay.
In the movie, he doesn't have many connections. He has a friend who he connects with, but she and him don't really connect. He's a real person he doesn't connect with. And then the friend who calls him out of the blue to follow his wife doesn't really connect with. He doesn't have a lot of connections in the police force. He seems somebody adrift in society. He meets this woman, Madeline, starts following her. He starts to connect with her. He sees her. When you first see her, he's always seeing her through something, through a window, through a mirror. So there's this idea that he's not seeing the true representation of Madeline. And he starts obsessing about what he sees and not who Madeline is. And then he falls in love with her. And you have to remember, she's also supposed to fall in love with him. And so she reciprocates it. And then things happen. And then the relationship moves on relatively quickly. Right. But he's one of those people that seems to be all or nothing. And he tells her he loves her. They go to the, and then she loves him back, and they go to the mission. The whole incident in the middle of the movie happens where he's going up. He gets up the bell tower. He gets vertigo. He's trying to catch her. And then you see her, you hear her scream at the top, and then her body falling down. And then he realizes that he failed again to save somebody because his vertigo got in the way, and he leaves. And there's a whole inquest, and then he ends up going to a mental institution, and he comes back. So I really look at this as a very interesting study by Jimmy Stewart and Hitchcock, where you have a normal hero who is doing things, and we've seen in movies, but he's a detective who's following a woman who ends up falling with her. We've seen that story 1,000 times. And the more he moves into that story, the more unsettling it gets. He's taking apart the hero. And then after she dies and he meets Judy, we're going, oh, here's his redemption, right? He's going to meet Judy and move on. And no, he even moves farther down the obsession and completely dismantles the hero by the end of the movie. And it's very uncomfortable for us to watch. And it's one of those things where I sit there and I go, by the end of the movie, Jimmy Stewart is pretty much dismantled any part of the quote unquote hero part of the protagonist in this movie. The protagonist at the end of this movie, Jimmy Stewart, is a broken person, number one. Number two, he isn't, you really can argue that he's not the hero at all. We're expecting him to be the hero because he's put in that position in the type of story that Hitchcock is creating, which is why I think is one of the reasons why critics didn't respond to it. Because Jimmy Stewart wasn't known for those type of movies, wasn't known for psychological thrillers. He wasn't known for, you know.
Yeah, but he did Rear Window before this.
But that's not a psychological thriller in this way. He's the hero from beginning to end. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so this movie really dives deep into obsession, and obsession makes everybody do things that are not comfortable to watch and comfortable to for the story. And it's very uncomfortable. And I think it really talks a lot about how much does Kim Novak's character, both characters, when she's Madeline and when she's Judy, how much does she have actual control over her body, over who she is? Everything that we know about Madeline at the beginning is told to us by the husband and just reinforced by Jimmy Stewart's perception of her. And then at the end, the whole point of him with Judy is that he tries to make, he makes Judy go through and remake herself to look like Madeline because of his obsession. He does not, he instead of loving the real Judy, he would rather remake Judy into the image of Madeline. And it's really uncomfortable for us. And I think that's one of the points of the movie is.
Well, I also think for a person who identifies as a female, it is kind of uncomfortable for me to watch a breakdown of this, lack of a better term, manic pixie dream girl because of the fact.
I don't think this is a manic pixie
dream. I think it is because of the fact that.
She's not cute or trying to be bubbly or any of that stuff.
Well, that's not a defining feature of a manic pixie dream girl. The defining feature of a manic pixie dream girl is a girl character who usually is on the either has some issues or is cute and bubbly and alternative that brings the man into the story, and the man falls in love with her, and she makes the man see things in new ways, and he falls in love with her and, lack for a better term, becomes obsessed with her, which is what we see with romantic comedies all the time. This man has never connected with a woman ever before until this woman, alternative or alternative woman who picks up a book one time and he's like, oh my God, it's my favorite book, whatever. This woman is different than all the other women in the world. And he falls in love with her. And she's billed as the perfect woman for this man, for any man. One of the reasons why I kind of think of Kim Novak as a manic pixie dream girl is because most of these types of characters don't have their own backstory, don't really get to control their own body. They are more of an object than a character. And I think that breaking down of this trope, even in the late 50s, and then seeing it now, it's always been uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to break down things that we just view as normal. But if we actually think about this man character being obsessed with this woman to a fault, all of the movies that we watch now, if we put that lens on, become a lot more scary than we perceive them to be.
Yes, I see where you're coming from. I think, though, that this character is even deeper than that. I think it's even a deeper psychological thing. Number one, we don't know anything about Madeline except what her husband tells Jimmy Stewart's character, because that's part of the plot, because he is trying to kill his wife.
Yes, I'm not
so
faulting that.
So the idea that she doesn't have a backstory because of the writer is not, or the way the story is being told is not the point of the story is that she literally has no backstory because we don't, because of the what is no. being told us.
And I think the reason why I'm not saying that the writer is at fault for not giving her a backstory, because that's part of the story.
And I think that's a very interesting point about Kim Novak's character in this, is that, yes, she, in some ways, she does fall into that. I think the thing that's even deeper than that is that this is the way a director directs a film. He takes actors and he molds them into the people that he wants. And Hitchcock was famous for the Hitchcock Blonde. When we meet the real Judy, she has a backstory. She is a real person. She has more color. She's a person who's earthy and has a real life. And then Jimmy Stewart starts to put his obsession on her and mold her back to what he wants in a love, and basically take somebody who's real and shift her to the unreal, so he can have the love interest that he thought he had with this other person. I think it takes that a little bit out of the manic pixie dream girl thing. She's a willing participant in that at the very end. She actually goes along with it. She could have walked away, and there's a scene where she's about to walk away and she chooses not to. And I think that's the part that makes me go, yes, there are parts of this that, yeah, maybe it's a proto,
it's a breakdown.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at, is that she's not a manic pixie dream girl in the sense of that's her character defining characteristic. It has everything to do with the breakdown of what men want. So it's kind of, so to me, it's very interesting that when he meets Judy, she's in bright colors. She has her own makeup on. That's really,
her own life.
She has her own life, and he can't take that. He can't take it, and he doesn't want it, and he doesn't want a relationship with her until he can mold her into what he wants, which is a woman that he can project all of his insecurities on, all of his issues on, and doesn't have to deal with any of her life, which is what a manic pixie dream girl is to a male character, usually, where she's like, I don't really, if she has a backstory, it's usually a tragic one, and that makes her mysterious and sexy, but she doesn't have her own story arc, because she's just a backboard for the male protagonist to deal with his own issues. And that's why I thought it was very interesting and made me very uncomfortable to watch an older man manipulate this younger woman into becoming his, lack for a better word, plaything.
I can see what you're talking about the manic pixie dream girl concept. In Hitchcock's films, characters tend to not be well-rounded. It's the one knock I have about him as a filmmaker is that you can break down most Hitchcock films as, this character is the cool blonde. This is the man. This is the lead who's been accused falsely. That kind of stuff. It's like there's different things that he has in his films that are like that you can pretty much say this is a Hitchcock trope. I think this one, the male lead, which in most of Hitchcock's films would have had the redemption arc at the end, where he would have met Judy and figured out the murder and solved things and blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, he keeps going down the path, which is why I think the critics didn't receive it very well in '58. It wasn't really well thought of. I think people kind of pushed it away, thinking that it was Hitchcock's weird movie about love and obsession. And so I think the thing is that the structure of the film is, he's going against our structure or what we think is going to happen about this love affair and things like that. So I think over time, people got to watch it and realize what he was going after. And I think it's a very personal film too, because I think I don't know about you, but I think he was commenting about the way that he makes films and the way that he obsesses about the films. And in fact, he obsesses so much in the pre-planning stage, like I said, about structure and writing and all that, he used to hate going and actually physically filming the film, because he had, by that point, he knew exactly how the film was going to look in his head. And he thought all the work of the filming was actually the boring part. He thought the filming part was boring because he'd already filmed it all. In fact, he never sat by the camera. He would sit away from the camera, and he knew exactly what you're going to do, this, you can do that. But his obsession about the film from beginning to end, I think it's a very personal film. The more I look at it now, it's like I think he was commenting on, this is what I do. And he tapped into all the things that were uncomfortable in his own psyche and made films that point out those things to people. And some of them people really, really liked. And sometimes, like this film, they're really uncomfortable about.
Well, I have a question for you. And it's kind of just like a question, but it's, this movie did not do very well. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why people think it didn't do very well is that Jimmy Stewart looks too old to be in this film. And famously, this is the last James Stewart and Hitchcock pairing. Do you think Jimmy Stewart is too old to be the hero in this movie?
He photographed older at that point. It's ironic because like later on, Cary Grant would go make a couple more Hitchcock films, and Cary Grant was older than Jimmy Stewart, 4 years older, but he filmed younger. Critics pointed to the Jimmy Stewart being too old for Kim Novak. But if you go back through the 30s, 40s, even sometimes in the 20s, older actors with younger women is nothing new.
It's nothing new now.
And I was gonna say, and if you go all the way past this movie, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, right now, older men, younger women, nothing new. Nothing new as far as pairing. Now, there has to be a connection. And I thought that there was a connection between Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak in the film. It's not the traditional romantic connection, but then again, this is not a traditional romantic drama. It's about obsession and people being deceived and all that stuff. So there's a lot of different emotions going on. So I think the scenes that they had together, there's a lot of different things being played. And I think they did a pretty good job hitting those notes.
I don't think this movie would work as well if Jimmy Stewart was younger or photographed younger.
Yeah.
Because I think part of the reason that makes him kind of like an everyman, start at the beginning of the film, an everyman to a, I don't want to say villain, but I can't think of another word, is the fact that he's an older man with no connections to the real world, fixated on younger woman fantasy.
And we also know that the husband that he's talking to, the friend he's talking to, isn't young looking. He looks to be a peer of Stewart.
He is a peer because they went to college together.
Yeah, but he also looks it. I mean, how many times have you watched a movie where they said, we went to college together, and you're like, no, one of you was the teacher and one of you was the student, if that's true. All right, you know what I'm saying? But no, they looked like they could be college buddies. And I think that's the thing that this film is, that she already married somebody who's much older than her. So at that point, I think that argument is, or supposedly had married somebody much older than her, because we find out that Kim Novak's character isn't the actual real wife. But that's the thing is that we, at this point, have realized the Madeline in our brain that we have built is a younger woman who married an older man. So when this younger woman falls in love with Jimmy Stewart, in my brain, even when I was a young kid who watched this movie when I was going through my Hitchcock phase, when I was like 13, 14, 15 at the video store, I'm like, it doesn't ring false, because we've set up the fact that this young woman has married somebody older. I think the critics and everybody were trying to find a reason why it failed. And I think the reason why it failed at the box office isn't because of Jimmy Stewart or Hitchcock or Kim Novak. I think they were all good in this film. I think it didn't work because people weren't expecting it. And they wanted something. They thought this movie was going to be different. They thought it was going to be a suspense thriller along the lines of the two other movies that Jimmy Stewart made with Hitchcock, which were pretty straightforward. And this movie is not straightforward. And so I think people were grasping for straws. And I know Hitchcock famously said he wasn't going to make another movie with Jimmy Stewart because he was too old. But I don't know. Maybe if there was a movie that where he wanted an older guy, he would have gone back to that. Hitchcock famously said a lot of things and then would go back and do something exactly opposite. So,
well, that also, like, there's context to many quotes that get taken out. So this movie, like we said before, has two halves.
Yes.
Of this movie. And
because that was a big problem for Hitchcock. That's why he spent so much time working on it. Because he was trying to figure out what would drive the guy's obsession at the second half. He understood the first half. He finds somebody you fall in love with, and then she, you know, dies. But what would get his obsession going even more? To change the woman. He wanted to know what changed the woman. So that's why he really wanted to work on that. And I think that's, some people would argue that maybe he never quite found it. I think he did find, for him at least, the spark that would drive him for the obsession. So yeah, it's a movie two halves, and it's a structure that we don't normally get a lot in film. We have all the way up to one point, and then there's a shift at the midpoint or just past the midpoint, and then you have like a second half. Some films like Boogie Nights and Goodfellas famously have that shift where it's like it's all going one direction, and then it takes a hard left and goes another direction for the rest of the film. Even though it's the same story, this is one of those films that does it very similar to that. It's a one direction, and then all of a sudden the person you're following dies, and then it takes a total left turn, and then it becomes really a movie about obsession. At the end,
Are you talking about Vertigo, or are you talking about Psycho? Because that was like you take out all the specifics, and both movies to me are about obsession. Well, one's about obsession with the mother, and one's obsession with a lover, which all can discuss.
So I'm going to ask you, so we kind of touched a little bit about this earlier. Some people call Vertigo the ultimate film about the male gaze.
I can understand that assessment, but they've pretty much said that about many other movies. I think the fixation on changing a woman and making her into your desired partner. Like, he doesn't kiss her on the lips and doesn't until she's fully formed into Madeline again. And so I can definitely see that assessment of he's not wanting to get to know the woman. Famously, that shot, which is probably my favorite shot of the whole film, of Judy coming out of the bathroom in full Madeline garb, turning into this, like, she's kind of has this, like,
ghostly appearance,
and she's covered in green light from the hotel sign, which, fun fact, is actually in San Francisco and is now called the Hotel Vertigo, but the hotel that they shot at. So, which to me is kind of like this, that is the point where she's no longer a person, she's an object.
Yes.
So, I agree with that assessment. It also, we should talk about Kim Novak's character, Judy, is a willing participant because of the fact that she loves this man as well.
Yeah.
And wants to be with this man. So, we, as women are taught from a really young age, that to become a person, to have value, our value comes from men and their belief in us and their love in us and their whatever. And so I definitely think that this is about male gaze from both sides of the coin. She wants to be validated in his eyes because she's taught that without the validation, she is nothing, and he can only validate her when she becomes his dream girl.
I think that's what Hitchcock was talking about when he was making this film. Is like, dude, all these thoughts are in my head when I'm making my films. These are all things these are all things that I think about and I deal with. These are all things that are our society's things, and we're just not talking about it. I mean, that's why I think it's one of the more personal films he made in the middle of a studio system, which is another reason I think it was surprising. It's like, I'm surprised that a studio executive watched that film and went, yeah, this is cool, totally cool, and put it out. I mean, they had to, they just finished, but it was like, I think it's very interesting that when he pitched that idea, the studio exec was like, yeah, let's do it. He was also making movies for Paramount, and Paramount really needed help. So that brings me to the thing I was going to ask you about. So I kind of feel that this movie was self-aware. There's enough interviews where he talks about this film after it, where he talks about, no, this is her doing this is the equivalent of her offering herself up to him. And this is him, you know, that he won't kiss her until she becomes the vision of the dead woman. So there's enough parts where he's like, it's said in different interviews, I feel like he's very self-aware of what he's making. He's talking about the fact that he's creating what we would call the Hitchcock blonde in front of us on screen, which makes it even more unsettling and more uncomfortable. That he understands that the blonde woman that he's creating on screen, this cool blonde that becomes the staple in a lot of his films, is a creation that he has made. And he is showing you that it is owning up that it's an obsession. You don't make so many movies with different actresses playing the same part. You have Grace Kelly, Eve Marie Saint, you have Tippi Hedren, you have Kim Novak, you have all these women playing this part throughout these movies without owning up to it. And I think this is him saying, yeah, it's uncomfortable. I'm sorry. This is more self-aware than most directors at that time.
At that time, yes. I think it's also kind of that thing of like, I'm self-aware, but I'm not going to change my ways. I think this movie, even if it's self-aware, doesn't absolve him of all of his problematic behavior. There's always going to be a little bit of a misogyny when it comes to the 1950s. And so you can say, like, this is the unsexy part of making a movie. I strip everybody bare so that I can manipulate them the way that I want. It doesn't automatically say, like, just because you wrote a movie about it and tell everybody about it and society, look at yourself and put a mirror up to society, doesn't automatically resolve you of your tendencies.
So we talked about watching this film not in the best circumstances with the commercials cutting in and out. Do you think that interfered with your style of watching this film for the first time?
Probably, but to be completely honest, I watch most of my films with commercials in them because most of the ways that I watch, you know, historic movies and movies that everybody goes, oh, you have to watch it because you love film, you have to watch this film, I usually watch with commercials anyways.
Okay.
Because of the fact that that's how I grew up, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's kind of, for you, you said that it messed up the way that you watched the film, but you grew up and had most of your formative years during a time when video stores were a thing. And like, yeah, I do have video stores and Netflix doesn't have commercials and I get that. But you had film that started from start to finish. I have, you know, Peacock, where you get commercials every 5 minutes. Because it's, you know, free television. So it's kind of that situation where it's like, I've watched Oscar winners with commercials. I've watched dumb comedies with commercials. So it didn't really affect the way that I view the film.
Yeah. I think that's harder sometimes going back and watching older films. That leads me to the second question is, was this the film that you expected?
I mean, I've seen many of Hitchcock's films. This one I have not, but I have seen, the staircase scene that's so important to film and things like that. So this, to me, because of the way that most people talk about this film, about being like, oh, without this film, we wouldn't be doing all these amazing things. And it's going to be, you're going to love it because it's, you know, so technologically advanced for its time and stuff. To me, I think people built it up for me because they knew that I was going to be watching this film, and I think that might have actually ruined the way that I view this film. I really enjoy the end, I really enjoy the beginning, but to me, I don't think it's worth the hype that people give it.
So I don't know, I understand what you're saying about it being technically sound and all these great things. And you can look at it and say, yeah, it's a great movie. It just didn't connect with me. Because the same thing for me is Barry Lyndon by Stanley Kubrick. People love that film. It gets high regards. In fact, I think it's in the top five of both of those lists on Sight and Sound. I could, you know, it's like everybody looks at it, it's like it's an amazing accomplishment. But it doesn't connect with me personally. It doesn't connect with me on an emotional level.
Well, to me, it's like what should we judge a movie on? What makes a movie great? And to be completely honest with you, technology and composition should be a part of the grading system, but it shouldn't be the only part of the grading system.
No. I don't think these people on this list are saying that. It's an amazing film because it's technical. I think they really connect with it. I think that means something to them. I think it's a good film. I even acknowledge it's not my favorite Hitchcock film because it does not connect with me on the emotional level as some of these other ones do. And there's other film directors who none of their movies have connected with me. I understand that. It's just we have a different vibe. So it's like, I totally understand where you're coming from when you say, like, yeah, I can see it as being good, and it's not a bad thing that I'm never going to maybe watch it again or something like that.
I'll probably watch it again. I get Joneses for just random films. To be completely honest with you, I think the acting, Jimmy Stewart's acting, I think this is probably one of my favorite films that I've seen him in.
Yeah.
Like, as an actor.
And I also think it's one of Kim Novak's best roles. And she had a very interesting relationship with Hollywood. She eventually leaves Hollywood and becomes an artist in another way. And I think much happier person. Jimmy Stewart and her make a movie right after this called Bell, Book, and Candle. It's supposed to be a romantic comedy, and it doesn't work. And I'm wondering why, and it got universally panned. And I'm wondering, it's like, how would you have to go from this movie to a romantic comedy with the same people? How would you be able to make a romantic comedy with these?
Are you serious that the thing is called Bell, Book, and Candle?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's the ladies' shop in Goodwitch. Her witchy shop is called Bell, Book, and Candle.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, that's why I was like, wait, are you serious?
Yeah, it's called Bell, Book, and Candle, I believe.
Yes, it is called Bell, Book, and Candle.
Yeah, and it's a romantic, and it came out literally right after this movie came out, and it gets universally panned, and I'm wondering if it's because, how would you be able to build a romantic comedy with the same leads that were in this movie that were telling you that their obsessive love leads to their downfall and one of them died?
Yes, by casting a love spell.
Yeah.
So it's like a witchy romantic comedy.
It's a witchy romantic comedy.
And her shop in the witchy romantic comedy TV show is called Bell, Book, and Candle. Somebody knew this. Somebody knew this in the planning department.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad to talk to you about this movie. It's a hard movie to talk about because there's so much you can go into. So thank you for listening.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review. You can follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema. On Twitter, at TML A Journey, and on Facebook under The Movie Log. You can also find us on the web pages at www.tmlajourneythroughcinema.com.
Have a good night. Thank you.